on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Enlightenment is not a fence that you leap over and you find yourself in Buddhist Disneyland,
right,
where everything is blissful and, you know, just there's no strife, there's no conflict. The Buddha talked about saving people from suffering. And it took me a while to realize that when you save somebody from drowning, you don't drain the ocean. And so I think that really what's being said is he saves us from the effects of suffering.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, Zen priest, author, and actor Peter Coyote joins me to discuss his book, Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. Peter discusses the value of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths, nirvana as freedom, faith-based in experience, how enlightenment is not a goal but something you already have, and wilderness is a model of Dharma. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Peter Coyote is an award-winning actor, narrator, and teacher. Recognized for his narration work, he narrated the PBS series The Pacific Century, winning an Emmy Award, as well as 11 Ken Burns documentaries, including The Roosevelts, for which he won a second Emmy. A Zen student since 1974, in 2011, he was ordained as a Zen Buddhist priest, and in 2015, received transmission from his teacher, making him an independent Zen teacher. The author of Sleeping Where I Fall, The Rain Man's Third Cure, and Tongue of a Crow, as well as The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet Buddha. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. Peter, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thanks so much. I love the title, Rebel Spirit Is Us.
yeah, it sure is. I just wanted to say before beginning that I very much enjoyed your book. I identify as a Buddhist, but I always say I'm a bad Buddhist, mostly because I don't belong to a Sangha. And I think that to say I'm a secular Buddhist would be a little bit less self-judgmental. But when I began studying Buddhism, it was Zen that attracted me to the teachings. So I am very much looking forward to this conversation and your insight and wisdom. The first question I have for you, I thought we should discuss the title, Zen in the Vernacular. It's a really interesting title, and I think it also addresses a greater project that you're working on. So what does the title mean?
Perfect question. So let's just start with the fact that Buddha didn't speak Japanese. He was born in Nepal, and he had this insight, and wherever this insight spread, in the first instance, it was in a Hindu culture. And so to a certain degree, he cloaked his teachings in the gift wrapping of the culture that he found himself. He did that so as not to offend the king or offend the people or the values. So there are certain aspects of Buddhism, like reincarnation, for instance, that are not at all emphasized in Zen or in Buddhist teachings for that matter, but they were mentioned because they were part of the Hindu culture. And in every country it went to, it cloaked itself in the attributes of that culture to some degree. So by the time it got to Japan, and by the time Japanese Zen got to America, it was cloaked in all sorts of exotic practices that represent the marriage of Shintoism and Japanese nature worship and Japanese high culture achievement. And it's very easy to mistake this exoticism for the wisdom itself. Just like when you look at Tibetan Buddhism, it's easy to get lost in the exoticism. So I'm very grateful for the Japanese tradition, and I love the aesthetics. And I have a little tiny zendo with, six tatami mats in it, and black cushions, and pretty Japanese. But I began to realize after 8 or 10 years of practice that these exotic attributes could always seem foreign to Americans, and it might stop them from being interested in it. And so by the time I got around to make, well, my book that we're talking about now came about after a series of lectures that I gave during the COVID pandemic. I was asked to do them, and they, I'd sometimes get 1,000 people online. People were uptight and stressed. And so I had all these lectures done, and one of my students had transcribed them all. And when I read them, I thought, well, I could do better. I could make this more precise. I could make myself a little smarter where I was stupid. And so I sat down to turn it into a book. And what the book is about really is loosening the Japanese gift wrapping around Buddhism, not getting rid of it, loosening it, hopefully to expose the Buddha's gifts more clearly to Americans, and to show them that many of these exotic sounding states of mind and practices are not foreign at all. I mean, I've seen machinists who've disappeared into their work, just so concentrated there's no room for a self. I've seen women do that with knitting. These are human states. And so I wanted to take a shot at transcribing the Buddha's teachings clearly and simply for Americans in such a way that it would feel accessible to them.
Okay, wonderful. And I'm very curious about how this manifests in America. And I very much appreciate this because I do know that there is this tradition that Buddhism would adopt the cultural forms that it went to. I understand it as upaya, which is skillful means, but I liked your language of gift wrapping because but it is a gift. And I think I identified perhaps some of the key ideas that you may be identifying for American audience. And the first one that I wanted to ask you about, I didn't want to go into the Four Noble Truths or some of the other teachings, although we'll probably address some of those. But I wanted to start with this whole idea of enlightenment and awakening, because I think that many people in the United States and probably other parts of the world as well have a different view of what this is, of what awakening is, and you connect it to freedom.
I do. That's my experience of the experience. I'll tell you what it isn't. Enlightenment is not a fence that you leap over and you find yourself in Buddhist Disneyland, where everything is blissful and, just there's no strife, there's no conflict. The Buddha talked about saving people from suffering. And it took me a while to realize that when you save somebody from drowning, you don't drain the ocean. And so I think that really what's being said is he saves us from the effects of suffering. So here's why it's worthwhile going into the Four Noble Truths. It's really quick, but when you find out that your suffering is not a result of a spiritual inadequacy, when you find out that suffering is actually part of the world, and the word I prefer more than suffering, which has a Christian tinge to it and also tends to sound more mental than physical, the word Buddha used was dukkha, and he defined it. He said dukkha is birth, it's death, it's sickness, it's pain, it's being stuck in situations that you don't want to be stuck in, it's being denied access to situations that you do want to be stuck in. And he called them a noble truth. So if truth means anything, it means real. And if noble means anything, it means dignified and worthy of respect. So he's telling you that the nature of the world is that all things are afflicted. Mountains are afflicted by sand and wind and rain. We live in a peppered wind, and these afflictions come and they're not our fault. There's nothing we can do about them. And so one thing we can stop doing is blaming ourselves. So the second noble truth is called Samudaya, and it means arising. And it means that when you're afflicted by something, thoughts arise. Feelings arise. A guy cuts you off in a car, you want to give him the finger. Somebody's rude to you, you get irritated. That's not your fault either. It's just cause and effect. And this is the energy that's basically keeping everything moving. If we all got enlightened at the same time, we'd probably be mushrooms. We'd probably just be sitting around happy to be in the dirt. So the third noble truth is the first one where you can actually do something about it. And that's called Nirodha. And the image of it was a clay wall that peasants used to build around their fire pits so that flames wouldn't leap out and burn down the village or burn up the crops. And it means containment. And so what the Buddha taught was that by meditating and by understanding that all things are impermanent and changing, that you can contain whatever arises in you. And it's the running from what arises with you that gets us all into trouble. It's the running away from pain that has us shop too much, drink too much, gamble too much, wind up in the wrong beds, make our life, make it more complicated, make it less dignified, less noble. So the practice of meditation itself gives you a little perch. You're concentrating on your body and your posture, and you're concentrating on your breathing. And that carves out a little part of your awareness that your mind can't run away with. Normally, when we're thinking, we think of ourselves as those thoughts, and we go completely into the fantasy of that Eskimo woman in the wolf skin that's starting to get naked, and we're gone. But when we're holding part of our awareness on our posture, on our breathing, that's like a perch from which we can watch the mind. And that's a kind of detachment that leaves us free of the effects of the mind. Instead of being jerked back and forth, we develop a confidence in this stability and this meditative practice. And we learn through repetition. We develop faith through experience, not belief, but through experience, that we can see things as it is and we can withstand whatever arises. And around the point at which that becomes habitual, the last noble truth is Marga, which is the Eightfold Path. And that's where you're in the world and you're modeling the life of a Buddha in your own life. And he gives you these eight categories to think about. And of course, I can never remember all of them. But it's like right view, right energy, right concentration. And we don't even use the word right in my sangha. We use the word Buddhist because it's not opposed to wrong. It's just, is it consonant with Buddha's understanding of how the universe is? Is it consonant with an enlightened view? And so there are no Buddhist cops. These are questions that you ask yourself when you're talking about someone, and you can say, am I speaking kindly? Am I speaking correctly? Is this right speech? And if not, you correct yourself because you want to model the life of a Buddha and you want a noble and dignified life. So that's really the simplicity of the practice. And the other important thing he taught was called dependent origination. And this is the basis for the Buddhist idea of emptiness. And what it means really is know this, know that. No sunshine, no apple tree. No apple tree, no apple. No apple seeds, no orchards. And it works this way in every dimension. No oxygen, no Rick, no water, no peat, no sunlight, no microbes in the soil growing our food, all the way out to the Earth's place in the universe. If we were any closer to the sun, water would boil off and we wouldn't be here. If we were farther away, it would freeze, we wouldn't be here. And this place in the universe is being held by all the gravitational forces in the universe. So we have two realities simultaneously. The one is you're on your side of the screen and I'm on my side of the screen. If you get stung by a bee, I don't say ouch. So we have an awareness of a separate body, a sack of skin, what the Chinese used to call the guest, because the bodies come and go. The host is awareness, which is not personal. So we have that self-centered awareness, but we also have this awareness that we're all parts of one big thing, like we're all like ticks on the body of a dog. And without both of them, our self-centeredness runs away with us. And we spend all of our time trying to protect ourselves from feeling small and insignificant, and we want to get wealth and power and fame and riches and all of this stuff. But when we remember that literally just opening your eyes, the entire world is waking up. And when you go to sleep, the entire universe is going to sleep. So these were really the two kind of dominant teachings, and they're pretty simple, but getting the hang of them takes a lifetime.
Yeah, it does. I think, you know, one of the things I've always appreciated about Buddhism is the moral aspect is not about following some dictate. You know, the Buddha's like, you know, it wasn't like, you know, thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do that, but rather it's kind of a virtue. It's a practice that you constantly work at this sort of self-improvement.
That's right. And that's why you shouldn't call yourself a bad Buddhist.
I know. I know.
You're either on the path or you're not on the path. And as my teacher said, when he asked me to take priest training, I said, oh my God, no, I'm an idiot. I can't help anybody. He said, listen, there'll be people ahead of you you'll learn from. There'll be people behind you that you'll help. And it's just like that. We're all somewhere. The Buddha's still working on himself. Yeah. But you put your finger on something, which is that in many ways, Buddhism is not actually a religion, because the Buddha was stressed that he was a normal human being. He was not holy. He didn't have all these magical attributes. There are some practices of Buddhism which feel very religious, faith-based practices of Buddhism. But Zen certainly is one of the most kind of cool and intellectual practices, not for everyone. And from that point of view, when we bow to Buddha, we're bowing to enlightenment. We're not bowing to a man. We're bowing in gratitude for these teachings.
Right.
Where it's not like, you know, it's just, it's not like Jesus. It's not like Muhammad. It's not like Moses, who was the singular human at the start of the history of the Abrahamic religions. So it's quite different. The feeling's quite different. And one of the things we have to be careful of is not aggrandizing it. You know, we're just human beings. We're just another bozo on the bus, and we're just trying our best. And when you read about the Buddhists in Myanmar burning Rohingya Muslims, you realize that no one, no practice is immune from greed, hate, and delusion, which are the big three afflictions that humans are born with.
Yeah, the three poisons, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it broke my heart when I started reading the stories about what was happening in Myanmar, because I used to be able to say, you know, I didn't think that there were any Buddhist caused wars.
Yeah.
You didn't hear about it. And now, like you said, it's, yeah, we're very human. Even the Buddhists are human, and it's all practice. And even a Buddhist can fall short of
You
the
bet.
ideal. Yeah.
And so it's worth remembering that when you just circling back to talk about enlightenment, you know, if enlightenment was the antidote to all suffering, Buddha wouldn't have suffered and died after his enlightenment when his friend King Bimbisara was starved to death by his son. He grieved quite publicly. These were long after his enlightenment. He had a thorn in his foot that got infected. So it's not that affliction ends. It's that we get a better toolkit for dealing with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's always one of my concerns is I'm constantly thinking about how people sort of understand enlightenment and awakening. And my personal guidepost is a quote by Thoreau, who said that I've never quite met a man who was quite awake. If I had, how could I look him in the face? So,
yeah, it's a beautiful quote.
You know, so,
so
it's like, you know, we're all working towards it.
Here's a couple things to think about. First of all, enlightenment is not a goal.
Right.
It's something that you already have that's obscured. And it's obscured by the kleshas, by the poisons that you mentioned.
Right.
They distract us. Our deepest nature is Buddha nature. And I think of Buddha nature as the formless, pregnant energy behind the universe, except it's not behind because it's always expressing itself by turning into forms, some form or another. So there's just, the problem with the idea of a fixed self is that it's fixed, right? If I ask you where yourself is, you can't tell me where it's located. You can't tell me the shape. You can't tell me the color. You know, if I tried to sell you a car and say, well, I don't know what make or model it is. I don't know what color it is. And I can't remember where I parked it. You might be dubious. So Buddha would never answer the question of, is there a self or not? Because it leads you into contradictory baloney. But he was very clear that it's not fixed. And one of the problems that happens to humans is that from the moment that adults talk to us when we're an infant, we have no defense against their description of the world. So look at the little lovely cheek, look at the face, this is mommy's face, look at the bird, look at the dog, look at the cat. And all children are indoctrinated into the culture where they live, and they grow up, and at a certain point, they can run the unbroken film of that narrative. And as they do that, they learn by inference who they are. They learn by the way people respond to them who they are. They learn from their own responses who they are. And over time, that idea of a self gets solidified, almost like the armature in the center of a sculpture. And so we like to say, well, I know myself. But if that's the case, your growth has stopped because you're a fixed entity. And what the Buddha reminds us of is that we are an awareness at root. We are fluid and formless, and there's an absolute freedom to that. And if there are things about yourself that you don't like, they're not fixed. They're habits, and they can be resisted and unwound with suitable labor. So we're all in the same boat as far as that goes. If we think that we are a separate, discrete part of the universe, well, then we have a life that begins and ends. Then we have loss and gain. But if you realize that your awareness is not a personal prize, animals are aware, plants are aware. For all I know, the sun is aware. I always bow to the sun every morning because none of this would be here without it. So what we try to do is learn how to live with both those concerns simultaneously. Yeah, I'm just a mortal human being here. It's like I'm going to turn into light one day or, you know, worms, who knows. And I'm all of it, because without all of it, I couldn't possibly exist.
Yeah. And I think that's a incredibly important idea, that the interconnection, that we are so radically interconnected to absolutely everything, that we are part of it, and it's part of us. And I like this goes back with what you were just saying to this idea of nirvana being freedom. And one of the things that you wrote is, this is a quote from the book, "Nirvana is a practical term for a life in which the fire inside us is contained in an understanding of our innate freedom, which allows us in the next moment to drop our personal history and narratives, become something completely new and different." That is radical freedom.
I think so. Yeah. Works for me.
Yeah. Well, I really like that. And I want to kind of build on this idea of freedom, but I also appreciate the notion of, and it's the old Zen idea of, you know, what do you do before enlightenment? Chop wood, carry water. What do you do afterwards? Chop wood, carry water.
That's right.
That we are still part of the world and we still have to act in the world. But I think that this notion of freedom is something that is very, I think an American audience, it seems to be a core part of that Zen in the vernacular for the American audience.
Well, I think Americans have a pretty immature idea of freedom. I think we tend to define freedom as doing whatever I want, whenever I want.
Right.
And that's a self-centered point of view, but it's disregarding the other half of the equation, which is we're attached to everything. Mm-hmm. If I piss in the stream that goes down to your house and that's your drinking water, you know, my freedom is impinging on you. So I think it's one of the reasons that Zen tends to concentrate on very small, very tiny actions that you do completely, and you try to extend your sensitivity so that you can carry as much of your interdependence with the world with you as you can. I'll tell you my favorite koan. You know what a koan is?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but go ahead and say what it is for anyone who doesn't know.
Koans are kind of teaching riddles. And they usually can't be solved by logic or intelligence. They have to be absorbed until your intuition grapples with them. So in the 13th century, there was a disciple of the great Dogen, who was the man who brought Zen from China to Japan, named Fuketsu. And he gave what to me is my favorite koan and really the most important. And he said, if you pick up a speck of dust, the nation prospers. If you don't pick it up, nothing happens. So, okay, thanks a lot, Dr. Freud. So what he meant was, compared to the immensity of the universe, doing anything is picking up a speck of dust, building a Zen temple, fighting for world peace, saving the last whale, building an empire. It's a speck of dust. And for those people that feel moved to try to aid others in pain or suffering, you have to pick up the speck of dust. You just don't have the option. There are people that are not moved by the suffering of others, and they don't pick up the speck of dust, and nothing happens. But Fuketsu goes on to caution those of us who pick up the speck of dust. And this is the most important thing he says. When you pick up the speck of dust, you're picking up the entire world. You're not picking up just your good intentions. You will cause as much suffering as you do joy. You will make as many mistakes. You'll do as much harm as you will good. It's unavoidable. The universe is half positive and half negative. And when you pick up the entire world, you pick up the negative half as well as you do the positive. So the caution is, you don't wax enthusiastic about what you're going to do. You don't, for instance, say, we're going to go into Iraq. It's going to be a piece of cake. The oil is going to pay for the war. The people are going to treat us like heroes. We're going to set up a democracy on conservative principles. So in we go, and within about a month, the people realized the only thing we cared about was the oil, and the first improvised explosive devices appeared, and we were in this incredible quagmire. So the alternative to that kind of thinking is to be more like a fox. You take a couple of steps, you sniff the air, you look, everything okay, you keep going. You continually reevaluate what you're doing according to what's going on around you, because what's going on around you is going to change. So you're not saved by your good intentions. When you set out to do something, you even in Zen monasteries, there's envy, there's competitiveness, there's seeking promotion, there's all sorts of human stuff, because we carry the nature of the universe within us. And if we don't know it, we're letting ourselves off the hook from monitoring ourselves to making sure that the negative aspects don't come through our speech or our physical action. If we think that we're the good guys, we've already left ourselves free to do whatever we want. We've put all our negative sides on other people that we call enemies, and we drop bombs on hotels in the middle of the night in a foreign country because we don't like their leader. So, but ask the people who were bombed who the terrorists were. Right. So it's a pretty strict understanding. My friend David Harris, well, the late writer and just great hero to my estimation, civil rights activist, and he was married to Joan Baez for some time. He ran for the Senate. He went to jail as a draft resister. He said, values that are not expressed in action do not exist. And that's a tall order. So if we sit around and we complain about, you know, the powers that be and this and that, it's meaningless. It doesn't separate us from the problem. If I complain about, you know, pollution and carbon, I'm still a part of this culture. Even if I drive an electric car and have all these LED lights and everything, I'm using enough to support a Guatemalan village just by my life. And so it's a tall moral order to realize that we're participating in the very things that we disapprove of. Yeah. But it keeps us humble.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things I really appreciated about your book, was especially the third section where you address a lot of these social and political issues. And I particularly liked that you saw them as being spiritual issues. And, you know, that's sort of my approach and what I've done most of my work in, especially in regards to our environmental issues, as I have long maintained that these are spiritual issues.
Of course they are. Yeah, of course they are. And it's actually, you know, people who are trying to carve out a special spiritual dimension for behavior that has no pain in it, that has no strife, that has no contest. Well, they're just trying to carve out the stuff they like from the universe and from their personalities. All of these problems are caused by human beings and by greed, hatred, or delusion. You can see that there are genetic inheritance. They once probably served us. If we weren't aggressive and greedy, we might not have survived. If we weren't antagonistic to people coming after our food supply, we might not have survived. But once you get into a world with nuclear weapons, you can see all that stuff is out the window, because there's nothing that makes us more aware of the fact that we're all in this together, because there are no victors in a nuclear war.
Right. Yeah. And there are no victors in global climate catastrophe either. No winners there. And I also thought it was interesting, especially in regards to the United States and how divided we are, that you saw that as well as a spiritual issue.
Well, I think about this all the time. I'm doing something which I'll save for your last question at the end of the show. What are you working on now?
Yeah, okay.
But I wrote an article, a long article, about the stations of the cross between the end of the 60s, where the forces of capitalism, unregulated capitalism, and neoliberalism combined to take the field away from the kind of implied leftist values of the 1960s. And they went on full-scale attack against the universities, against television, using their corporate advertising, building think tanks backed by millionaires like the Koch brothers and Richard Mellon, Scaife Mellon, and these people, to actually, in 60 years, move America to the right. And I tell this story, and I wrote this article. It's too long for any magazine. So some people are helping me turn it into a documentary using AI imagery, and we'll post it on YouTube where it'll be seen. So, I mean, this division to me has much to do with a consistent betrayal of urban and rural working people for many, many years. Since the New Deal of Roosevelt, there have been consistent efforts to unwind it and end it. Neoliberalism, which is the belief that markets are natural forces that should never be altered, regulated, or, you know, put under the yoke of social consciousness, has done incalculable damage. And when President Clinton and Larry Summers and Robert Rubin kind of turned the Democratic Party into a neoliberal party to go after the big banking money and the hedge fund money and the stuff the Republicans heretofore had gathered, urban and rural people got left behind, really. And the end of Reagan's union busting and anti-democratic procedures and right-to-work states, they just destroyed the wealth-producing mechanism of the middle class. And so GATT and NAFTA shifted out millions of jobs. Deregulation collapsed banks in the savings and loan scandal, took $250 billion out of small accounts and savings and pensions, did it again under Clinton in 2006 and 7 and 8. And the way that I read the people that were invading the Capitol on January 7th was these are people who had just given up. They didn't care. They didn't, you know, they turned on the news every day. They were the same cheerful people with good hair and expensive suits, chatting and talking and coming up with ideas. But they were just working three jobs. They were falling behind. They can't afford college. They can't afford education. And they took a Hail Mary pass on a grifter and a sex offender who campaigned with Bernie Sanders language. And they believed him. And so to me, the great inheritance, the great malign inheritance of the MAGA movement is its the disrepute, its spread on norms and the law and the ways in which the values which make a democracy possible. So if you doubt everything, if you suspect everything is a fraud, everything is a fix, there's much in political life that would justify that, but it can't be everything.
Right.
And so I'm actually quite worried about the state that we're in, because no matter who wins the election, there are going to be 40% of the population that's going to be really miserably unhappy and angry. And it's going to take us decades to repair this if we don't lose democracy.
Right. Yeah, no, I appreciate all of that. And it speaks to how I see things as well. And, you know, I look at like all these claims and criticisms of the media, you know, and we also often hear, you know, fake news. But there is a reality about the corporate control.
Exactly right.
You know, and that reality kind of gets swept under the rug. And what I always try to do is just develop compassion for the people and try to understand them. And I do the same thing with Donald Trump, where instead of saying, oh, I hate him, I think he's horrible, I always look at what it is I don't like about him and then turn it back onto me and say, oh, yeah. I don't like his arrogance. Well, in what ways am I arrogant?
That's a Buddhist practice. Yeah. You know, I don't like the fact that I am made of the same thing that Donald Trump is made, but he has equal standing from the universe which created both of us. So my task is to think, what experiences did he have that made him this way? And what are the best ways that I can counter it? If my father was in the Ku Klux Klan, if my father drove my younger brother to or older brother to suicide, I might turn out like Donald Trump. So it's just kind of wasteful. And our practice as Buddhists is to say, okay, he may be the trigger to get you angry, but the emotions are yours.
Right.
So our practice is to immediately disregard the trigger. Somebody cuts you off and you get angry. Forget the trigger. The anger is yours. You own it. So you have to investigate it. I wanted to say one other thing about the news. Part of this article that I've been working on is when Reagan came in, put into power by the forces that were backing Lewis Powell and neoliberalism, he ended something called the Fairness Doctrine, which was what mandated that the news discuss every aspect of a story, that if they, if someone was a guest on a show and spoke badly about someone else, that someone else was invited on to defend himself. So in the mid-60s, the news shifted from nonprofit to profit centers for the corporate sector. And as soon as that happened, the strategy of the news changed, because instead of just delivering the highest quality of information, being like the hood ornament of a Rolls Royce to attest to the excellence of your network, suddenly everybody was going after the largest possible audience, which is like the equator around the earth. And to do that, they got younger, hipper, sexier, more convivial talking heads, you know, moderators, pundits. They made the news stories quicker and simpler, less nuanced, less complex. They treated everything like horse races to keep you breathless. And the real strategy is to keep your eyeballs in front of the screen for their sponsors. And because the news is so complicit in that, it's never discussed. These talking heads, many of whom I respect and like, but they get bonuses for increased web traffic. They get bonuses for increased viewers. Their structure of compensation is tied into the success, which means the size of the news agency and the amount of revenue it returns. And the result of that in the last 50 years has been the dumbing down of the audience and the reducing of every idea to he said and she said. So Mr. Hitler wants to kill 6 million Jews. Mr. Schwartz doesn't want any. How about starting with 3 million as a talking point? And that's the way they have these think tanks on the air. They never tell you who they are. They never tell you how they make their money. They never tell you what their political persuasion is. They're all just under the rubric of experts. Mm-hmm. And so, sidebar, I worked for Jerry Brown in his first two terms as governor. And he kind of liked the fact that I was so unambitious. I didn't want a career in politics. And he trusted that. And he comes to my house to argue with me. We talk about stuff a lot. And the other day he was over for coffee, and I said, listen, I could solve this whole thing with three changes, and we could cut the Gordian knot binding so many problems to us. Full federal funding of elections. Every candidate gets the same amount. We watch what they do with it. Prohibition against corporations spending tax deductible dollars to influence public policy for their shareholders, not the American people, their shareholders. And third, the prohibition of all gifts, junkets, emoluments from lobbyists to legislators. It would bring different people into the government, and legislators would be able to make decisions based on the facts. And Jerry said, you're exactly right. It's never going to happen. And I can see why he says that, because the entire system is organized around money, and it's inconceivable to people to get out of it.
Yeah.
So that could be our karma.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be. And everything that you were saying about the media rings true. One of my favorite movies is, I forget what year it was, 76 or 77, Network, That's the most prescient movie I've ever seen, I think.
Well, did you ever see the show with Jeff Daniels on TV called
Newsroom, I think.
Yeah, Newsroom.
Yeah, I've seen a few of it. Yeah.
Aaron Sorkin.
Right.
I mean, it really explained how the news operates.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's kind of high IQ, but it's good information.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I know that we're running out of time, but if you don't mind, I had one other question, line of questioning I wanted to ask you about. And this I'm also connecting to America and this Zen in the vernacular. You quote several times one of your primary influences, which is Gary Snyder. And one of the ideas that runs through this in conjunction with freedom is wildness and wilderness. And one of the things that you wrote about Snyder is that he said that wilderness is the model of Dharma.
Yeah, I think that's true. So what wild means is self-organized for its own purposes. In other words, trees grow for trees. Foxes operate for foxes. And they're not subject to human constraint and control. So when you look at the diversity of wildness, and you look at, Snyder once said, the hawk, the swoop, and the rabbit are one. You can see that on that scale, perfection exists. And you can see that in the turmoil and turning over of things is a model of how the Dharma operates. And if we need to be refreshed in our understanding, nature is an available remedy, palliative, and balm to much of what afflicts us.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. So I know that we are pretty much out of time, but let me ask you, you kind of mentioned a little bit of what you've got coming up next, what you're working on. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that?
Well, yeah, so there's a friend of mine named Jan Friel, F-R-I-E-L, and he started something called Observer Wikipedia. And Observer Wikipedia is a kind of progressive Wikipedia. And they feature an encyclopedic number of events. For instance, it's a place where you could read about archaeological excavations that have discovered cities with no hierarchy, no huge temples. All the houses are spacious. Everybody has access to the same goods. And it brings new information into the discussion. And what he discovered was that the architecture of Wikipedia is the architecture that news media uses when it's searching information. So he's the one that suggested that I turn this article into a documentary. So I write a lot of letters to the papers. So right now I've come up with another 20-minute documentary on the theater of protest, how to do protests without letting them get turned into Republican campaign videos. I was invited to Harvard in 2020 to teach about protest and stuff, and I gave this lecture, and it's like four simple rules for running a protest that recognizes that the true audience of a protest is the American people. You're not talking to the police, you're not talking to the political sector, you're not talking to the authorities of your school. You're trying to convince the American people that you are trustworthy, and that if you have them behind you, your cause will prosper. So the four simple rules are: appoint proctors, give them yellow vests and whistles. All they do is they watch for violence. And at the first sign of violence, they blow the whistle and the real protesters sit down. And let the police take their jollies out on the people that are wrecking small businesses and the provocateurs. The second is dress like you're going to church, which is exactly what the early civil rights protesters did. It's hard to be painted as thugs if you show up in your best clothes and you're neatly dressed. The third one is work in silence. Let your signs do the talking. Let your self-discipline be advertised to the American people watching you that you're not going to do anything that would embarrass them or make it difficult for them to support you. And the fourth one is go home at night. Come back the next morning. You can't tell the cops from the killers at night. So go away and come back. And if you do that, then you're addressing the actual audience and you're operating the ceremony of a protest in such a way that you're inviting people to a better world. Nobody accepts an invitation when they're being screamed at. And while it may be great for young people to virtue signal and scream and holler about important moral issues, by the way, I did this during the Vietnam period and the civil rights period, but the fruits of me and my companions' excesses elected Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan to the presidency. And we got 20 years of deregulation and anti-democratic stuff as a consequence of concentrating only on this single issue and not knowing that we were actually wooing the American people. So I'm going to make a little documentary about that. And I'm just going to explore and see how well these do on YouTube and how much they get seen, because it's like a new venue and it's much larger than my little local newspaper, which prints all my letters.
Right. Well, and it sounds like that model that you're proposing, that sustained protest is part
That's
of
right.
It.
Yeah. I'll tell you something you may not know. In 1962, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, 14 of us at Grinnell College decided to go to Washington and protest in front of the White House. We were afraid we were not going to get to grow up. There was going to be a nuclear war before we got agency and power. And we thought that our politicians in Washington needed to know this. Ho, 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 how little we knew. Anyway, we raised the money. We fixed two old cars. We had a press conference, and an executive in Des Moines of a big insurance company gave us a brand new Chevy and three walkie-talkies. We drove to Washington and we walked in front of the White House, all well-dressed, carrying signs supporting Kennedy's peace race, calling for an end to atmospheric nuclear testing. The John Birch Society was shadowing us, eating fried chicken and throwing the bones at us. And Kennedy was flying to Arizona and he saw us on the front page of the New York Times and he invited us in the White House. It's the first time in history protesters had ever been invited in. And we were staying in this little rooming house called Gaunt House, perfect for a 3-day fast. And Marcus Raskin came running in. Marcus Raskin was the chief of staff for McGeorge Bundy, the architect of the Vietnam War. He's Jamie Raskin's father, Congressman Jamie Raskin, another hero. And he was super excited and he explained to us the importance of what this meant. So we went in and in that meeting, I realized that we were just a problem to be solved for his president. He didn't care. We were no more important to McGeorge Bundy than if we were waving goodbye to the Queen Mary. And I thought, the only way you'll ever get this guy's attention is to come back with an army. And I thought the army might be the counterculture. But while we were in Washington, we sent out letters pre-internet to about 150 colleges. And we got them to send students in to keep the protests going for a year. And in February of 1963 was the first 25,000 student demonstration in Washington. And Tom Hayden called the Grinnell 14 the beginning of the student peace movement, protest movement. So I say this in response to your use of the word sustained. You have to be sustained. It means you can't burn yourself out. You can't operate at such a level that you can't keep going forever. And you have to keep going that you don't bring a counter response, you know, that's violent and destructive. And so we did that. And, you know, here we are. We didn't win everything, but we made a lot of changes, just like the counterculture did. Okay. Counterculture was really the germination of the women's movement, the environmental movement, alternative health modalities like acupuncture and Reiki and all of these things, alternative spiritual practices. So we lost all the political battles, but we won the cultural battle. Right. So organic food is everywhere now. People are talking about global warming. We haven't overwhelmed the power of money, which may do us in, but me and my people and my like have been sustained. And even the Diggers, which was the most anarchistic group of all, we have 108 of us still on an email link. We chip in every month to carry about 15 of our members who got old. We can give them $200 a month, which is a little grace to their Social Security. So there's much to be said for sustaining.
Yeah. No, I ask because it seems, in my experience, a lot of the protests that we see currently, it's just one and done. You know, I think in terms of like the women's marches, and people went and they felt really good and were able to express their frustrations and whatnot, but then they went home and never went back.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's like, I mean, you have to know who the audience is.
Yeah.
I don't make light of anybody's moral outrage or suffering. I mean, during the Vietnam War, watching children being burned by napalm and civilians being killed and stuff, it's agonizing. And it's easy to let those negative feelings govern the way you operate and to say, well, this is such an emergency that I don't have time to be civil. I've got to rub this in everyone's faces. But just think for a minute about these college demonstrations that have screwed up graduations, right? For thousands and thousands of not just fellow students, but families who worked very hard to get their kids an education, were looking forward to a great event. So we don't know what the consequences of that will be, but it's certainly not going to win any friends for the Palestinians or any enduring possibility of political reconciliation. And that's something that you learn as an old man. You often don't learn it as a kid.
Yeah, wisdom of age. Wisdom of age.
Some wisdom.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Peter, I know that final question. Website or where can people go?
So petercoyote.com is a wonderful website that's been made for me by a woman named Susan Gratz, who took my old moribund website and made it visible on cell phones and gave it a breath of new life. And pretty much everything I'm doing is there. And also you can go to YouTube and look up Hosho, H-O-S-H-O, Peter Coyote, and all my Dharma talks are there. They're fun. I mean, I stand by them. I'm writing books now because it gives me a little more control. What else am I doing of interest? Smelling the flowers.
Well, that's important. It's always important to smell those flowers and to take a moment.
I have a granddaughter who's going to college in September and a daughter and a son. And, you know, they're living healthy, exemplary lives, you know, fully human, but fully committed. And so are the children of most of my friends who seem to have followed suit to their parents' values. That's a reaffirming and a wonderful feeling.
Yeah. I imagine so. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time and sharing your wisdom and insights. And again, I just want to say that I very much enjoyed the book, Zen in the Vernacular. I think it's very approachable. And I think that anyone, even if they aren't thinking about being a Buddhist or don't identify as a Buddhist, can find a lot of value in it.
Well, thanks, Rick. This has been a lovely conversation. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you. And that's a wrap on episode 146 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, which has several perks, including early access to episodes, a book club, ad-free episodes. Trust me, I know how annoying ads can be. Please share this with friends, family, and on social media, and subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing. All of that is really important. Right now, putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it, but it's very time-consuming, especially since I always read my guest book when they have one, and so I can have an engaged and informed conversation with them. Many of my guests have told me that they truly appreciate that I've taken the time to do my research. Not every podcaster does that. I hope you, my audience, my faithful listeners, appreciate it as well. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the Rebel Spirit, and you know, I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your Rebel Spirit.